Yes, I'm really keen to have a discussion about what might be an emerging field, almost. It's certainly, to my mind, a kind of, in biology, a kind of bottleneck in progress is helping more people to come in and think dynamically. And I can do a sort of story of my own journey from that point of view, which is a slightly helpful. So I'm a geneticist by training. My roots are in genetics, and then more specifically developmental genetics. And as far as I'm concerned, genetics is really about genotype and phenotype and the relationships between them. And over the years I've been working in genetics, I've been very fortunate, I think, to be working in the kind of molecular biology revolution, which has meant that it's been possible to do forward genetic screens to identify things by phenotype, and it fairly rapidly now, in the early days, at painstaking slow rate, but now fairly rapidly identify the underlying gene. So you've got some genotype-phenotype relationship going on. The drawback with the molecular biology revolution was that it kind of led to this obsession with, I guess, the central dogma. So the central dogma, what I want to do, DNA, RNA, protein. And that gets you a very, very small distance between genotype to phenotype. And there's been lots of excitement about these proteins and how they interact with one another and how they regulate DNA and therefore gene expression. And to me, there still is this huge gulf between where we are and where we tend to focus and phenotype. And as we've collected up more of the genes and proteins that are involved in generating the phenotype, we've begun to emerge into a more interesting place where we're looking at the dynamical interactions between those things and the behaviours, particularly in developmental biology, we've heard lots about those so far, that allow these proteins to influence phenotype. The core properties of them are dynamic. They have very little to do with which proteins they are, which we've all been desperately obsessed with for many years, and much more to do with how they work together and connect up the pieces. I think there are various different ways for thinking about that. And there are very important kind of aids to thinking that have underpinned our understanding of this part, which we now actually have to throw out in order to allow ourselves to think about this middle part. And we've heard about that in various ways. I think actually Thomas' talk this morning was particularly good at highlighting some of those things. So we've tended to think hierarchically, that information flows in a particular direction. It's very obvious that that's not a good way of thinking about things. Information is moving in all kinds of directions, in all kinds of pathways. We've tended to focus on the parts themselves rather than their interactions, and all of this, I think, has left with this massive gap in the middle. I've mentioned to a few people as I've been talking about this, partly my sort of desperation to try and find easy ways to help us think about this gap, kind of intellectual tools to get us into this place more intuitively, comes also from working in various other domains like policy, where you also have parts and, you know, sort of parts at different scales, I suppose, of the system, people over here and strange behaviours in the economy over here or something, and you want to connect them. And people are also very keen to think in this linear kind of way. And maybe a good example of that is, and just to give you an idea of the kinds of things I'm thinking about, are these kind of traffic idea. So actually also with the auction transport stuff I talked about, we have a lot of analogies to do with traffic flow. So if you've got major highway and you're interested in making sure that cars move along it, there's the parts, there's the road and the drivers and the cars, and you can think about all of those parts. And then sometimes the traffic's moving along nicely and sometimes there's a traffic jam. So what can cause a traffic jam? It can be something straightforward and intuitive and linear, like roadworks blocks the road, all the cars are incredibly slow-moving lorries, but it also can be these rather more interesting things where a small perturbation, you know, one driver sneezes and slows down, and as a result of that, the guy behind overbrakes, and then you get these so-called traffic waves. Although the other interesting term for those, which is in the, you know, if you talk to people about them, is these phantom traffic jams. And that, I think, captures what I'm talking about. Those kinds of things that emerge from dynamical systems, from those kinds of feedback-driven regulations, all of those kinds of things, look mysterious. They look like you have to invent a ghost to come and do it, rather than being a you know. And so I think it's really important to the field that we help biologists like me and other people who have not typically thought in those terms to come in and think in those terms, give them access to those kind of dynamical systems components that crop up over and over again. So I think that's one key reason for trying to create the intellectual tools we need to bring people into this gap in the genotype phenotype space. It's not intuitive, and we need to make it more intuitive. What do we need to do that? I think we need to define some parts, which is the way we all think, in this system, where the part is no longer a physical protein-y thing, it's a module that has a particular behavior. It's a particular set of feedback interactions that gives you a particular sort of behavior. And what behaviors am I talking about? That depends a little bit on the system that you're interested in particular. So from a developmental biology point of view, if you're thinking at a kind of tissue level, one of the very best things that also helped me when I was thinking about what was missing to realize that there was some way, potentially a way forward, are Turing systems. So if you talk about Turing systems, developmental biologists, everybody knows what you mean. They know, they can immediately picture the little kind of wiring diagram in their heads, and we know that the kinds of behaviors that those generate straight away. Even very non-mathematical people can understand what a Turing system is. The interesting thing about Turing systems is they crop up all over again in many, many, many contexts, and they crop up with completely different underpinning pieces. So we've heard in this meeting about ones that are entirely physically encoded, essentially. They're all about physical forces working together in that kind of way. And someone was telling me about some that are essentially, back to the snail shell patterns. There are snail shell patterns that are nerveless. The network is the same. It's a Turing system, but it's not a fast diffusing and a slow diffusing thing. It's a neural network, essentially, that generates that fast-moving, slow-moving, positive, negative information interaction. So there's that kind of level of things. And then there's, you can think about it instead more if you've got much clearer bistability. So you're really interested in two alternatives. Is it one of these or one of these, or maybe three alternatives? Then there's the whole of the dynamical systems theory. So Eric and people like that have been working hard to bring those kinds of ideas into the whole biology space, where they've been before, but I think they can be again now in a more accurate way because we understand more about the molecular mechanisms underpinning those things. So we've got that kind of input-output thing, and then I think more generally thinking about information flow in systems, which goes in all directions up and down. You can also think, and Philip was telling me about this concept of transfer functions, where you can think about boxes that are really moving the information from here to here and how they're doing it. So I think there's lots of kind of heuristics for parts you could put in this space, but I think it would be very useful in terms of bringing people in from outside, but hugely in terms of how we communicate with one another as a community, to start drawing up a list of recognized things in this space with good examples about how they are occurring in completely unrelated systems, encoded physically in completely unrelated ways, so that people can get their heads into that space to get start thinking about those kinds of concepts. And so I think that's one thing I would really like us as a community to start doing, is making that list here and now or later somewhere where we can all contribute. And then the other slightly more kind of advertising thing is then to come up with a name for this field so that we can talk about it as a distinct activity. Because at the moment, either people just don't get it at all, or the terms we have are confused with other things, like the famous systems biology, which when it started, I thought, hooray, this means understanding how systems work. But actually, instead, these days it means building a very long list of bits that are in your system. And they are, it's interesting that term is so schizophrenic, because in many ways it describes the entirely opposite approaches for going about understanding a biological problem, and they're all somehow lumped together. So I think we need a different word that is distinct, that absolutely captures our interest in this gap, the things that go on in that gap that link the activities of the proteins and things we've spent so much collecting with actual phenotypes and in a developmental context, also with processes, as we've heard eloquently about so far during this meeting. So I'll stop waffling and see if anybody says anything. James has also thought very hard about this and written a nice review, I thought, that also talks about it kind of in the context of epistemology almost. And it is an epistemological shift, I think, that we need to get people into this space.
So a couple things come to mind. So Turing refers to some very particular mechanism, local activation, global inhibition, type thing, right? But if I understand correctly, you don't necessarily look to identify these sort of, okay, let me use the word universal, I don't know how, universal is not the right word, generic mechanisms. So maybe one can come up with a list of some generic mechanisms, but I'd say pretty much any process, if you care to, in development, right? So developmental biology, right? Yeah, I'd say development is already referring to process, mm-hmm. right? So there is some dynamics that's implicit in that. And, if one sort of chooses to take sort of purely genetic approach and say, okay, well, what is the gene that turns antenna into a leg, right? Then, of course, all the process that happened in making a leg versus an antenna got subsumed in that one label, mm-hmm. right? But strictly speaking, development biology was supposed to describe that process.
Absolutely.
So it's not entirely obvious whether one really needs another name, but on the other hand, I certainly sympathize with mm-hmm. Sort of desire to identify yep. some intellectual yep. niche.
So,
just one second, just continue. Yep. So, but if you say that any process that you care to look at is, has sort of dynamical, important dynamical aspect of it, right? We can sort of immediately start making a very long list. So effectively, we can just take every talk that happened here, right, and say, okay, there's meristem and phyllotaxis, and there's some dynamical process which lays out primordia, and there is a dynamical, so spatiotemporal dynamics, up the gradient that's laying down these primordia, and it may have something to do with Turing, but in some very broad sense, et cetera, et cetera. Or, Dominique was talking about self-fate determination through asymmetric division, and again, right, there's a dynamical process, and if I understand correctly, yeah, Dominique is right there, right, students right now want to think about, following Dominique's talk, how this asymmetric division and determination actually yeah. works in the sense that one can sort of describe it as a deterministic dynamical process. But how do you see this? Yes. How do we go about making a list?
Because how do we at the go moment, about
we can just add the.
With difficulty.
Yeah.
But I would say, firstly, I would say, yes, we could just call it developmental biology, but I don't think that would help us very much shift people's thinking, because developmental biology, a lot of it is stuck saying, let's have some more parts, please. I also think that this thinking goes well beyond developmental biology, and it would be useful if we could come up with a term that was more inclusive. And most of the other stuff, I would say, is phenotypes, not that.
So just picking up on that, I think, so if I sort of interpret what you're saying, I think there's sort of two parts, right? Is that the a gene name is not synonymous with an explanation.
No.
But then in addition, that there is a level of description that is a useful level at which to think about, and a Turing mechanism being one such yeah. example. So rather than coming up with a sort of a list, could one think of it the other way around, of using that list as exemplars of the right, of an appropriate level of description. So beyond, so it fits in that gap, right? So yeah. it isn't a gene, but it is
yeah.
not just a phenotype, right?
Yeah.
This is development of the leg or something.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's stuff that fits in the gap, and I don't think we're ever going to have an exhaustive list
yeah.
that covers it all. But what I think we need is several things that are very helpful for people in this gap.
And what are the characteristics of that level of description?
Yes. Yes, exactly. I think that's important. And I would say, you can. So the character at this level, we're very familiar with these generic
yeah.
characteristics. We've got transcription factors and kinases and all of those kinds of things, and they generically regulate transcription and put phosphates on things. And you can talk about those with everybody, and everybody's happy. And actually, at this level, we're not doing too badly. You know, there are legs in multiple different organisms and all the rest of it. But in here, we're lacking, I think. And one of the things that's always interesting about these kinds of meetings is precisely that people hear a talk about patterning in Markantia undersides and say, oh yes, that reminds me of this, where I happen to know the mechanism is one of these. That kind of behavior is probably this kind of regulatory system. And if we were having some generic names and ideas in the middle, I think it would be much easier to have those conversations.
Maybe one random idea. I think trying to think of how to define the stuff in the middle, which reminds me of the definition of what is patentable. Mm-hmm. That's any description of how to harness the forces of nature. I think I don't remember the wording exactly, but so. Using the proteins, actually, mm-hmm. to actually do something, so obtain a phenotype, a product mm-hmm. in here. And that's, so you shouldn't, in theory, patent the protein or the algorithm or the, but you should patent the way to arrange things in order to obtain something. Mm-hmm. Is that the sort of process you're looking for? Well, not the process, but...
Yes. There's a kind of multi-scale thing as well about potentially about information transfer between scales, which is sort of similar, I suppose, in concept.
But should it be emphasized that there's a great deal of biological data that is static and a particularly endpoint, i.e. counting the number of legs or counting
yes.
mutant legs?
Yes.
And of course, that is exceedingly hard to fit to a model, because what you want data for is the dynamical process
yep.
when the system is thrown around between choosing your legs or antenna, whatever, mm-hmm. the process involved is. And if people were confronted with more data, would be manifestly dynamic in this mushy stage where biologists cannot classify it by just looking at the beast, that would, of course, force people to think about these intermediate states. And of course, if you're thinking about dynamical data, it's probably pretty low dimensional on a per point basis. Mm-hmm. So you're then invited to think about relatively low dimensional models, at least on a per cell basis. And low dimensional models, your dynamic behavior can be classified mathematically.
Yeah.
In various ways. So you could say that those are the sorts of models you should be fitting if your measurements are these relatively few variable things across a field of cells. And some of that can be classified, but people, and that's sort of, going from phenotype to phenotype, and of course that's become very predictive to the extent that, as I have done in a couple of cases, show that you could predict epistasis from fitting, single gene events to, to gene combinations. Mm-hmm. And if that works, you probably feel you have a decent model and you've accomplished something. If it doesn't, you're... Mm-hmm. But if there are more dynamic data around, then in precisely the time range when biologists can't make a visual determination of phenotype, it's typically an endpoint.
Yep.
A clear, obvious endpoint where the thing is really messed up.
Yep.
And you really want data at this intermediate time when you can't really tell what the hell the thing is.
Yes. I agree.
A lot of the low dimensional models, of course, are given by differential equations or something, but they have little process graphs with alternating substance nodes and process nodes, and one looks for loops categorized by their sign for the preliminary analysis, and often one looks for sets of loops that fight with each other, so a network, a dynamical network analysis, which features these graph properties in a competition, and then if you wanted to bring biology to more biology to it than that, you would like to add labels to these mm-hmm. process nodes and object nodes that say it's a kinase or whatever it is.
And so
maybe for the low dimensional dynamical models, one is looking for a little zoo of these things with their analyses into competing cycles.
Yes. Okay. I think this low dimensionality thing is quite important. When we're talking about, if we ever get to talk about names for the field, I've heard discussions in systems biology about what they call data-rich systems biology, which is the one where you make the huge list of all the paths. And then the bit I like is called data-poor systems biology, which is a bit of a pejorative name and not necessarily what we're interested in. But nonetheless, we've heard a lot about
data-efficient.
Yes. Sorry?
Data-efficient.
Data-efficient, yes. About abstraction, and then you come up with the Einstein quote about simple as possible, but not too simple. So this low dimensionality, I think, is a key property of these parts that I'm imagining in here are no use if they're insanely complicated. They've got to be, tractable. Now, I think a difference would be you were discussing fitting the model to having the right kind of data. I think you also do need to be able to create a model as a hypothesis based on your known interactions going on here or at whatever level, rather than a true model fit to data type approach. But that's okay. You come up with the same kind of thing in the middle either way. Sorry, Naomi.
Yes, so based sort of reflecting on this data poor thing, and also here we are talking about genotype and phenotype, and a Turing model applies to non-living systems as well.
Absolutely.
And it's more like principle.
Yeah.
That could apply very well to many biological systems too.
Yeah.
So are we looking for new field, or are we looking for biological principles that sort of sets of major principles that can explain many different phenomena, that including development? or are we kind of specifically saying, let's use dynamical systems to understand better about those principles underlying development? Like,
okay, so that's kind of several things at once. So I think the useful things that fit in this space come from a number of different fields, and they absolutely come from engineering and maths and computer science and operational research. I mean, all kinds of different things. And though I've been kind of interested in where colleagues have collaborated with engineers and other colleagues have collaborated with mathematicians, and they wind up with something that is mathematically essentially the same model, but even those two communities don't necessarily, they have such different languages even between those communities that isn't immediately obvious, even though the maths, in my idealized world, maths is the universal language of everything, and everybody should immediately be able to recognize if the maths is the same, but apparently that's tricky. So the fact that we want to fill this thing with ideas from across of all those different fields doesn't necessarily immediately unify it. Are they fundamental principles? I'm not sure that I would say a Turing system is a principle. But I do hope, which gets back to the Boris's point, that the things in here would be, I'm not sure generic exactly, but generally useful, and they would apply across multiple different systems, and that would be the whole value of them.
Okay. Yes.
So maybe another way of combining the threads here is to say that, okay, so just about every interesting process is dynamical. And but of course the description that we're looking for is simplification, right? I'm very fond of this emergent simplicity, right? So my friend Eric there then is happy to go to the extreme and say that there are actually some normal forms that can be written down and that thing can literally be enumerated. Which would be, I guess, one useful list of generic properties. Alternatively, you say, never mind, even if I can't enumerate them all, I may still seek a method for going after discovering these simple structures, even if, there isn't a enumerable set of such structures. Right?
Yes.
And so this, of course, is horribly vague, but to the extent that you're trying to define a field, mm-hmm. so the field can be defined by philosophy, method, mm-hmm. Goal, and the goal of attaining simplicity is quite distinct from what's happening in system biology there. That actually seems to pride itself on hairball graphs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so I agree that whilst I think for some things, there are mathematical formalizations for a list that is at some level not exactly complete, but David.
Most activities in biology are description. Mm. And I remember once a very nice thing that René Thom said was that the role of science is to reduce the arbitrariness in description. Mm-hmm. So the extreme form would be that we describe the planets by sort of Newton's law.
Yep.
And in a sense, that's what we're searching for in biology. Right?
Yep.
But I like the way he put it, that it's to reduce the arbitrariness in description.
I think that is an
And the
excellent
parts
word.
Bit is kind of a totally arbitrary description, because we're looking for ways of describing biological phenomena that reduce the arbitrariness and therefore are at this higher level.
Yep, I think that's an excellent quote. I think you could argue that some of this parts categorization also somewhat reduces the arbitrariness. So I think saying that there are transcription factors and kinases is less arbitrary than saying there are proteins with this amino acid sequence, another one with that amino acid. But we want to ramp that up a level. I agree, and I think it's fair to say that the way we're moving in this field at the moment towards assembling this understanding the information flow to and fro in these phenotype genotype relationships is a bit arbitrary. We're doing our best, but we're all doing it independently, and so we're describing our system using whatever it was that came to hand rather than any set of more elegant classifications over the top of that. I mean, some people are obviously more elegant than others. But. James?
Can I sort of raise another thing as well? So this kind of discussion reminds me a lot about Brian Goodwin and Susan Oyama. So, and I sort of came to developmental biology too late to really understand why they've sort of largely been ignored. So were they never relevant? Were they ignored? Were they deliberately sidelined? Because it's the same sort of discussion, right?
The other thing that I find interesting about the fact that I've now kind of got drawn into thinking about this stuff is when I started my lab, I felt that developmental biology was actually quite a coherent field, and people were talking about, we talked about this too when we first started talking about this, big concepts, determination, commitment, all of those kinds of things. They're a bit phenomenological, but, there you go. And there were actually computational models for a lot of those things. But because we didn't know anything about how they were physically encoded, the entire field spent the next 30 years going here. And that was very exciting because you could begin to understand how these things were physically encoded. But at the same time, I think we forgot during that time what we were trying to do. And now this has become an end in and of itself. So I think... a lot of those bigger ideas got lost in the drive to identify the physical encoding of the small end parts. And then that's coupled to this linear information flow thing, which I find deeply frustrating. The number of people talking about the genome as the blueprint for life, as though if you had the DNA sequence, it would miraculously turn itself into an organism. That DNA is never naked. It's always sitting in a sea of information that was put in, it's the chicken and egg, only the genotype, the genome cytoplasm or whatever cycle. And that, I think there's two things that it's really hard for people to think about, which makes it very difficult for people to move into this. And one of them's dynamics, and the other is non-linearity. And if you have non-linear dynamics, then you're doubly screwed. And I think I struggle with that hugely. I would really benefit from either instantly knowing more maths than I do, or having helpful people reduce the arbitrariness of my problem to the point that I could engage with it more straightforwardly.
And you're not dealing with chaos.
No.
Which sort of chaos?
Well, dynamical systems chaos.
Dynamical systems.
So you're basically dealing, because that's not a good way to make predictable outcomes.
Yeah.
Right? You want to make an embryo, and you don't want to make arbitrary things. So you're dealing with dynamics, which is relatively stable dynamics.
Yes, there are things
on top. So there even are. Though it's non-linear, it's simple dynamics. So you're dealing with non-linear. I don't think that should be such a thing.
Then that's important. It's not arbitrary dynamics. That's sort of a real constraint.
So
if you were to sort of outline a program then, so you've got one component of that, which is, but what else is in your program? One part of this program is to identify examples of the kind, but what else does this program include?
for helping our...
So the name to be decided program, what are we going to achieve?
What are we going to achieve?
Right, so partly we're going to yes. identify these processes and give names to these
yes.
kind of processes.
But
what else is in the program?
There's this grand name thing, which I think is going to be useful. But and then I think we need to have more meetings like this. I think we have to have not like this nano meeting, but more opportunity, more bringing of the different parts of the system together, so that these things become embedded and. Yeah, which ones are useful and which ones are not useful, and so on and so forth. It's got to be a dynamic process.
Are you thinking about facilitating development of a modeling system for those key systems which can be used for many different examples? And is that once we identify those?
I think it would be useful if. There's never going to be an exhaustive list, and the point is useful things that help people think need to go in that space, and they need to be there in a way that is sufficiently documented that people can refer to them as a thing rather than reinvent them in multiple different ways with slight variations, because I don't think that will help. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but to be contrary and provocative,
yeah.
Right? You've just criticised systems biology as all it wants to do is categorise.
Yes.
But actually your programme is just to categorise things, just at a different scale.
Yes, it is.
Never scale.
I think this is a missing domain where things have not been categorized, and as a consequence, people can't think about them. I think this is absolutely a highly criticizable endeavor, because back to biology's description. Organisms are organisms. They don't think of themselves as having parts. They don't think of themselves as having cells or DNA or anything. They're just a collection of stuff doing the thing. We as people, in order to understand those, reductionism is amongst the most efficient ways to think about anything. And we're very good at reductionism down to this level. We have no reductionism tools in the middle, none.
Well, if I could just, maybe give a suggestion. The point was made earlier, one of the things you'll probably look for is a system with some kind of feedback loops of various sign and so on that are doing various things. And the point is that when you have nonlinear dynamics or multiple feedback loops, you don't want to keep reinventing the wheel to understand the stability of those systems or how parameter changes can lead to significant changes or jumps and so on and so forth. You'd much rather have a system that somebody else has spent a lot of time really drilling into to understand it, to be able to give you some flavor of what's likely to happen with the system that you're thinking it might fit your data or might be a model. If it's linear, the answers are much simpler, sure, and a lot of engineering is based around linear stuff. But the minute it's non-linear, these things can get much more subtle. And so I'd say that once you start to do this, you'll actually open it up a lot more to, for example, engineers and mathematicians who look at the non-linear modeling of proper modeling of non-linear feed systems with feedback loops. You'll open it up to them being able to be much more helpful as well. And also, you won't have, every time you have a nonlinear system, try reinventing some notion of stability and refigure it out, which is going to be really painful, I can tell you. So I think it'll speed up things enormously. It'll also cut down on people missing subtle points in nonlinear dynamics. So the point was very well made. You probably don't expect chaos, but how do you know? How do you know when that might switch on? And for sure, one thing you expect probably is to have limit cycles. Nature likes limit cycles. So what do limit cycles do? What do you expect to see? If you've never looked at limit cycles, you won't know what they look like. So I think that this program, I think, can really give you a lot of power to understand things much better.
But
dynamical systems theory exists, as David can teach us.
Yes.
So we don't necessarily need.
And I think that does a brilliant job on things with alternative stable states. I think it might be, I don't know, you can tell me, less useful at some of these kind of, you know, we've heard an awful lot about major kind of tissue movements and things, which are much more continuous than all the rest of it, or waves. I've learned a lot about waves at this meeting, and that there's definitely different sorts of waves and different known mechanisms for generating these waves. And if you had a list of different kinds of waves there were with basic kind of regulatory architectures and dynamics that drove all of them, and you saw a wave in your favorite system, that would tell you that there were the following three experiments you could do to distinguish between these different sorts of wave, and I think that would be quite useful.
Yeah, but there you're talking about sort of bringing different areas of expertise together, aren't you? Because you know, there are communities which are experts in dynamical systems, some of which are, you know, may not be very relevant to us, where you're looking at things that happen on large time scales and so on, and chaos, stuff like this. But there's a large community there, and they will have very good understanding. You may show them some biological problem, and they'll say, oh, yeah, this is described by such and such.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, your traffic problem was a nice one. I sat through a quick talk to a guy who was trying to get our students interested in traffic, and he showed us some data, and you could immediately say, oh, that's a cusp catastrophe, they all suddenly go through it. And you could see it in the data, and they'd never thought of that, because they'd never really never seen. But anyway, in terms of bringing expertise together, you know, that's a different process. But the thing I'd like to say is that in listening to the talks down here and other places I've been very recently, it seemed to me that they all fell into two kind of categories. They were either mechanics, which was in some sense largely physics. I mean, you kind of didn't go outside too far outside the realm of kind of the sort of stuff that Eric and Boris were doing years ago. Or it was a much more abstract thing to do with information processing. And what strikes me is that I don't think we've developed a conceptual framework for information in biology. People talk about it all the time. And we know what we mean when we have DNA and a finite alphabet and so on and so forth, but that's not relevant to when that gets shifted into some complex stochastic dynamical system that's doing some interesting biological thing, then what you mean by information has not been conceptualized properly. And yet that's at the heart of a huge amount of stuff going on in biology.
Absolutely. No, I think that information theory is also very important. We mentioned this transfer function idea, which I think is important. I agree that they're straightforward. There's physics going on that people are modeling, but one of the things that's interesting is the way in which those two fields are actually converging now, because information is being transferred through physical processes. And so you can't completely separate them, I don't think.
In fact, not, but I mean, just thinking about what it really means to talk about how biological systems are processing information is something I don't think we really know how to do it in general.
Can you sort of give a concrete example about what are you thinking of?
Well, so in a certain sense, if you take classical information theory and you turn it into the sort of thing that would be applicable in biology, you could, as a mathematician making a kind of overstatement, you could say that most information theory is about the fact that you have a probability distribution, which you think of as a response, which is a function which varies with the input, or something else. It could be your position in an embryo or something. What you really are trying to do is understand how that probability distribution changes as you change the input. And most information theory then works on trying to understand that. And that's very relevant in biology, for example, in a signaling system, it's directed. But then, like in the say systems we were talking about, where you have some landscape and cells differentiating into different states, then the relative information is you've got all those different states, and you've got a way the signals can push you into those states. So it's related. You've got a probability distribution on the outcome and thing and input, and then how does that change the probability distribution? But this is how do you turn this into a really coherent discussion and connect it to the other dynamics?
That's a different description. So, you know, with the list there of Turing, that was a list of dynamical mechanisms.
Yeah.
Whereas what you're talking about is much more statistical representation, description.
Probabilistic.
So let me suggest an example. I find it easier to think with examples. So suppose you want to specify a shape, some non-trivial shape. So how much information does it take? Now, how would you encode a shape? And we can approach this in various ways. You know, we can lay down some mesh and start counting, local degrees of freedom, and sort of reduce it to a problem already solved. Or you can try to approach it in some algorithmic way, except for your algorithm is going to be some physical process, right? So if I'm generating this shape by, buckling, by some von Karman instability, right? I can generate some nice, shape, right? Which, of course, is determined by solving some equation, and I only have one parameter to tune rather than a zillion if I'm assembling it from a random set of points. So, in that sense, I don't find the sort of formal information theory terribly useful, right? Mm-hmm. So if I have to assemble these points from a random cloud, I'll do one thing. If I'm controlling a physical process, I'll arrive at a very different answer. In the case of these two-dimensional surfaces, I can imagine generating it by some, physical process. There's some minimal way of generating it. Thank you, Gauss, very much. But it's not obvious that biology is actually following Gauss's prescription, whether biology actually has some other constraints or has some advantages to growing things not isotropically but anisotropically to generate it. I think thinking about information is really tied up into its constraints of biological process. And ultimately, we can think about biological process somehow informed by this kind of question. Maybe it will help us. I don't know.
So it's very interesting listening to this kind of alternative framings coming out, because at some level, I think that represents exactly the problems that we currently have. There are lots of different ways to think about this stuff. There are lots of different examples. I mean, we're in this space where there are many, many alternative ways to go. And I think that the list of things that I'm kind of hoping might emerge in here needs to be defined pragmatically. What is it that's been useful in helping us understand biological systems in the James sense of understand, that really moves you forward in thinking about your system?
Talking about that, like, I guess modeling it, the theory is great in terms of it gives you a general framework, but in one sense, the thing that links us all is quantitative, as in we all want to get quantitative data or use quantitative data. Talking about it pragmatically, in the sense that's this idea of wanting to get numbers, and rather than thinking about RNA protein directly,
I think that's right, but I actually don't think that helps. There are millions of things I could measure. If I have a minimal model, then I know what the important things to measure are. And so you can't start with the measuring.
No, sure, I'm not saying you should, but I'm just saying that there's prominent links everyone here, so it's a concept we should think.
But I think we're trying to find things that are useful in here. We don't know yet what will be useful, and we want to bring in as many people with as many good ideas about what might be useful as possible. And I think if you have a flag saying, this is where we are at the moment, can you help? That's also going to help us.
Yeah, I think a good illustration has been made because the point James asked the question is the probabilistic different to the other description. Mm-hmm. They're actually formally identical. Mm-hmm. You know, the correct description of something is the probability distribution function over it. When people write lots of ordinary differential equations, they usually don't put stochastic parts in, especially in control theory. They often don't. And so it looks like it's different, but actually when you do control over stochastic systems, it's really the same. You can just switch the noise down. So if you want multi-input, multi-output with something stochastic, there's a whole bunch of theory about it, and formally they're really the same. So it's an example where if you think in terms of the box in the middle, you realize there is something that ties these two things together. You don't have to... You bring together something that otherwise looks to be very different when it's not. Mm-hmm. I would argue anyway.
Eric?
If you want to create a list of little motifs and you're okay with it looking like something like the process diagrams that I mentioned before, there's a source of data. There are 641 manually curated data models in the BioModels database. I think very few of them are biomechanical, unfortunately, so you might have to poll participants here to get a few of those. And some of them are too big. Some of them are nice and small and have just a few feedback cycles and would illustrate some of the principles that way. And others you'd have to kind of extract the core. But anyway, there's a source of data that you don't have to pull out of the literature because it was quite a lot of work. And you could build your zoo out of things like sources like that.
The hard work then is to figure out which ones are the same.
Yes, right. You've got to find an isomorphic core, a subgraph that could be mapped into several of them. Obviously, just straight out cycles are example of that, but usually are not enough to give you something like a switching oscillator.
Yeah, so going back to this question on information, so it seems to me that there are, and Boris said, you could have different descriptions that would have different information content. Of course, the more you go down to the sort of molecular level, the more heterogeneous, the more complex, the more information you need to describe the system. But that's not what you want. That typically is where biologists come from. They come from this complexity and they try to, if possible, with collaborating with physicists, go to a more abstract level, where you hope to arrive at a sort of a minimal and sufficient set of information to describe the state and dynamics of the system.
Yep.
To me, really, the challenge is to connect this abstract level description where information is minimal. And this very complex world of, reality, whatever that means, where information is way too large, and you need to reduce the dimension of information down to something practical.
Yep.
And meanwhile, keep a connection to the real world to test further the model.
Exactly.
So having that in mind, and because you put Turing on the board, there's something I like about Turing is that he started in his paper to describe, how diffusivity and properties of interaction between chemical species give rise to spatial and temporal patterns of activity. But what's beautiful about Turing is that beyond this diffusivity, you could have Turing-like patterns in a world completely governed by mechanics, where local positive feedback and long-range inhibition is realized differently.
Exactly.
The mathematics to describe it will be similar.
Exactly.
But the way it's realized in the real world is different.
Yeah.
And so
exactly
here we have
point.
A description that is mathematical in nature, that it has sort of what we call a minimal set of information to describe an activity and a dynamics, but where the long-range inhibition would be sort of like elasticity, and local activation would be some kind of local feedback.
Exactly.
The actual neural nets also have Turing-like instabilities. There it's realized even differently, not even by diffusion, by some connectivity among neurons. So I just use this as an example to say that we can have a sort of, in a more abstract level, the minimal necessary information to describe, you know, a pattern, mm-hmm. which would be Turing-like in a very broad sense.
Yep.
And then we want to connect it to reality where how could this be realized in a world governed by chemistry / diffusion mechanics or mechanochemistry, and where geometry of neural connections becomes even essential, because yep. in neural nets, the way I understand it is that the yep. way you have long-range local interaction is by the complex topology of connections between cells which have these particular shapes.
Exactly.
So to me, this is an example of maybe how we could probably think about you know, managing information to describe in an abstract level or yep. real world.
Yep. You know, that is exactly what exactly encapsulates what I'm hoping we can do beyond Turing. I mean, Turing is such a successful example. I feel that there must be more. And I think the ones I've come across so far in this meeting is different sorts of ways, and then there's various alternative types of René-Thom catastrophe. I think probably can also fit into the list if we can get up enough different examples of those.
But Turing's just an example of an instability, and probably all the instabilities they are used by biology somewhere, if we could, all the natural instability
systems
are probably used somewhere.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, then the other kind of things like that you would say are these kind of global phenomena are things like oscillations and so on.
Yeah.
The negative feedback produces yeah. oscillations,
yeah.
and
yeah.
you know, biology would use that. Then there's the fact that, you know, if you make simple networks of genes, you're going to be able to create complicated landscapes that have multiple equilibrium yep. states in them, and you can use that then as some sort of informational process and so on.
Yeah.
But so these are what you're really listing are a load of mathematical stroke physical phenomena
yep.
that then biology uses.
Absolutely.
And that's a
Absolutely.
Different thing from what Eric was suggesting, which is more a list of models.
Well, the point is that you should be able to map those models into that list.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the point. The list is a useful source of examples that you might be able to map into your mathematical phenomena.
The more I listen, the more I think that the less I like the notion of a list.
Okay.
And you don't want the list, you want the method. And so this old-fashioned approach of actually looking at the phenomenon that you're interested in
mm-hmm.
and thinking about it
yeah.
and figuring out what are the relevant variables and
yeah.
what is the simplest possible description
yes.
to describe what I observe
yes.
and perhaps predict something that I haven't observed yet
mm-hmm.
and suggest an experiment, test the model.
Yeah.
It works in science, right?
Yeah.
And but one particular thing that actually hasn't made it to the board is there is a method, you know, that physicists use, phenomenological modeling, which does exactly that. It's an approach to modeling, which happens to be, so a bad word in biology, because it starts with you know, phenomenon and figures out right. drills deeper rather than builds from this list of parts.
Yep.
Right?
No, so
maybe the goal of your nascent
yes.
field could
yes.
be to promote you know, phenomenology in biology. It sort of rhymes with
transcendental phenomena. James's favorite term for the field is transcendental. So, I mean, of course, you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that I've learned over the time I've been doing science is every 3 years somebody says there's a revolution in the way we do science, and as far as I'm concerned, there is one way to do science, which is kind of what you describe, and that's always what we're doing. But the revolutions are to do with tools to help you do that better. And you have to articulate those, because otherwise people just spend their whole time going round and round.
But maybe we could call it phenomenal logic then. The underlying logical phenomena.
Exactly what you describe is what people should be doing, but they're stuck because they don't have access to the modeling space that you need to be able to do that.
So the other thing I wanted to say is that it's the risk in listing is to suggest that these are sort of different ways of engineering a problem.
Mm-hmm.
As if there was no necessary connection between them.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, everything evolves
Absolutely.
In biology.
Absolutely.
So a good understanding is one that would not only explain a phenomenon, but also explains how by tinkering with some parameters you can transform a kind of dynamics into another one.
Well, this is, I mean, what these catastrophes are all about. I mean, that's what they are, as I understand it, which is not very well. But it's exactly about how you move from one phase space to another.
But I think it potentially more deeper than that as well, right? Because you can think about how you can so microevolutionary
exactly.
change within
exactly.
microevolution terms, exactly. also at the macroevolution level, how you actually how you have innovation and novelty.
Completely. And I mean, one of the things I've been kind of interested in, and has not worked so far, but I'm pushing it for as long. we got into a natural variation project in my lab precisely because my feeling is that's essentially an evolutionarily driven parameter space search, and you should exactly be able to watch those kinds of things happening by looking at quantitative variation in the system of interest to you, which I think is
It doesn't have to be evolutionary. Just so in fact, right, this whole thing is part of a goodbye course, and on occasions I sort of try to summarize to students what we expect them to do as a QBio course, and that went as measure something as a function of something.
Yep. That's good.
It's a 10-second elevated pitch.
Absolutely, and you know, you're right. Of course, these transitions happen within an organism as it develops, as well as over time. But all of this is about how you get access. For biologists, because that's who I am, to these kinds of tools, which we don't have. Yeah. And the tools we need come from, you can frame them in different ways, but I think it would be really useful to help people get access to those in a way that didn't require them arbitrarily to find someone who was willing to talk to them about it for a long time, and then you just get there. It's arbitrary. It's getting rid of this arbitrariness in the interaction of different fields as well as the arbitrariness.
So is the thing that Dennis Noble used to talk about top-down, middle-out and bottom-up modelling, in a sense? Mm-hmm. This is the middle-out and top-down what you were asking for more of.
I don't know what the definition's of. Normally I want bottom-up. But
bottom-up is that there are some kind of nut cases in systems biology who believe that if you can list everything that goes, every component and their interactions, you could somehow make a model of a human or anything else less than a human, which is clearly nuts.
Yes.
I mean, that's the problem, and that, in a sense, is the bottom up. I mean, that's an extreme form of bottom up.
Or it's just nuts. Whereas a non-extreme form of bottom-up would be, I've discovered that this gene, actually the clock models are bottom-up models.
The clock models.
Yes.
Yeah, but they came from middle-out understanding.
Yeah.
I mean, understanding about what makes an oscillator.
Yeah.
And
I'm kind of interested in the interfaces between those things, as usual, rather than one approach or another. I don't think we easily, the biology community doesn't have a place to go to help it into the thinking that you need to do this type of stuff. And I actually think this community would be helped if we had had a common language in the middle there. I agree a list is dangerous and it can't be exhaustive, it's got to be illustrative, but even so I think it's a little bit helpful to think of maybe not a list, a collection or something, an illustrative collection of what we're trying to achieve,
sure.
coupled with a name, transcendental phenomenology.
Can I clarify a little bit more about these things, because we keep sort of calling it differently, but you said it's not principle, those examples, but is it like mechanistic themes or
so my more serious,
framework? Like
my more serious process. Suggestion would be process.
Process.
You want
processes.
Processes.
Yes, processes is quite a good word because encapsulates dynamics. But I think, to me, it's important that these are considered as parts at some level, because ultimately a lot of the things we're talking about are a bunch of these things strung together that collectively deliver a more complex behavior.
Think, can we call it process biology or something?
Process biology.
We know what we want to do.
That's a very interesting idea.
So just as perspective of a cell biologist, so the problem that I have is that usually either an excess of information or an excess of ignorance. But what I, I study my protein, right, and I forget with everyone else. But what ultimately I want would therefore be to have a heuristic so that if I have five elements of a system and an output, say robustness of signal, then what is the minimal architecture of a system that will give me that output? And maybe I need two more. That's what I need to look at. So in a sense, process is the right term, but process, again, for me and my colleagues, means linearity.
Yeah.
And what I think we really are thinking about are minimal architectures of systems that can be predicted.
Minimal architectures.
I should say that the notion, the theoretical notion of correlating everything to get the meaning of life is not uncommon, at least in biomedicine in Australia. the latest trend is machine learning on big data.
The way I rather rudely like to think about that is, there's a community of
big data's out, sorry. Machine learning's
in,
but big data's out.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But Boris described this process that you could go through to understand your system, and the thing is, it requires you to think. And I'm reasonably convinced there's a large part of the community who would rather not think. And so, what you do is generate a huge amount of data and imagine that the answer will appear.
I think the point has been made several times about information. Mathematicians years ago realized that information, Shannon described the information as Shannon entropy, and then Kolmogorov realized it was a very poor description, so he invented the notion of Kolmogorov entropy. And it's exactly to take this point that if you just look at data, you can have a very small algorithm that generates an infinite amount of what looks like totally random data, the number pi being a very good example. You cannot distinguish it from random statistical tests, even to 50 billion decimal places, but you can write a small code that will generate all those numbers. So the point is that if you can have vast amounts of data that tell you virtually nothing. You can have an almost infinite amount, of Shannon-type entropy, and it tells you nothing about your Kolmogorov system. So that's really, the bound, and in a sense, the lower bound is... Does nature hit some minimal lower bound, was the point made, or is it higher? And so, you want to think about, I just think there's a thing here with the word information. It's easy to confuse those two, and we need some clarity in the words as well as the thinking.
And beyond what you said, I would it's also important to consider not what is the minimal amount of information to actually, or the program to generate the system, but also the time it takes for it to emerge. Like, you cannot make a cell as we know it from randomly mixed biochemical components. You need time. It took a few hundred million years to generate the first cell, and you cannot make an embryo in a day. Yeah. And so the time it takes to print something already says something about, adds sort of complexity to the system, and there's information embedded in this time.
And the order in which things arrive.
Exactly, so...
Yeah. I like that idea. We should name it after you as a new form of entropy.
No, but it's we studied. I'm just basically...
There are resource-constrained versions of algorithmic information theory, and they give you a bigger number.
Yes.
Well, the problem with information is it's just one number, and there's very little information in it.
That's today's quote. Thank you, Boris.
But there are these developmental biology concepts, like historically, that we've sort of gone away from.
Yes.
Where do they fit in?
Yeah, as we talked about. I think they are probably, you know, English text versions of a lot of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because they're about, you know, reversibility and bistability and all of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's one thing we could do. So, you know, I'm not imagining we're going to start a kind of protein database type thing that has all of these things in. All we need to do is get the ball rolling on having this approach in the system. So one thing we could do, that James and I have talked about a bit, is write some kind of perspective-y piece in some place where people will read it. And one way one could frame that in the developmental biology context is say, here's a list of classical developmental biology concepts, and here's a list of model kind of heuristics that capture those in a way that is applicable across millions of different systems encoded by millions of different underlying component parts. That would be one kind of way to bring this to a place where we did something. It's a very interesting discussion, but at some point, in my view, we have to do something.
So if we take what you just said, and you need modeling heuristics, how are these going to be described in a way that biologists understand them? Okay, well, we got Turing, but like, what else do we have there? Like, how do you bridge that to biologists?
Yes.
Well, you can draw a wiring diagram for notch delta and put it next to the Turing one and note they're slightly different and keep going from that.
I mean, for Turing, I think it will be reasonably straightforward. There are lots of lovely examples and that are very different from a physical encoding point of view.
There are many other things, like in excitable systems, how you have a bistability, and how then you can transform temporal dynamics to spatial information by spatial coupling. So there are,
Yeah.
But I suppose all these things we've discussed fall under the general heading of nonlinear phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, you're talking about sort of somehow making biologists aware of and maybe partially understand nonlinear phenomena, known nonlinear phenomena, or nonlinear phenomena by looking at the system that are new. But these are, you know, all these things, Turing, instabilities,
absolutely the case that the things we have a difficulty with.
All just nonlinear phenomena.
Yeah.
So I think you also want to make the case that that's a useful thing to do, a useful level of explanation.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Nonlinear biology.
Yeah. Nonlinear biology.
Actually, you should take a trick from the British physicists who found that, found that they got no funding except unless they're in high energy physics. So they renamed themselves mainstream physics. So we should be mainstream biology.
Actual biology.
Yeah, one of the things that the name is useful for is selling. And one of my tests for is it a good name is, can you say using an X approach? So the number of grants I've had called taking a systems approach to refereeing, which means measuring a shed load of stuff. I'm being very rude about people who measure a shed load of stuff and make a list. But and you know, it's not that that entire approach is worthless, but nonetheless. I think it would help if we could use an X approach, and I'm not sure we can use a nonlinear approach, but on the other hand, maybe I'm asking too much if it has to be adjectivable as well as a noun.
Dynamical biology. That has a nice dynamic image to it.
Systems dynamics.
Yeah, I mean, you can use a systems dynamic approach for sure.
Dynamical systems.
Is it that simple?
Well, the machine learners have stolen the whole of statistics, so...
So Elliot likes to call it computational morphodynamics, but...
too much, too many words.
Too many words. Well, also there's a problem that it constrains it to morphogenesis, and it constrains it to computation, and that's not...
I think dynamics would have to be in it, I think.
I think dynamics would have to be in it somewhere.
Because really dynamics says that it's from within, you know, which is different between a living system and a non-living system, and that's... It's
are you looking for dynamical motifs? Or dynamics motifs
in the middle there. Maybe it's dynamical process biology. Mm. If we like process.
So the word that I like is of course phenomenology.
Phenomenological
biology.
Yeah.
You're not
going to
get your
girl off. Yeah.
an even more damning indictment on a grant. But, I mean, indictment one is it's too descriptive, but indictment even worse is just phenomenological.
I'm not sure I've ever really quite understood what phenomenology is, except for staring at a blank sheet of white paper.
Oh, I didn't have a flaw in that shot.
Abstraction, is that a big part?
It is, but it's also something that kind of puts people off.
Yeah, I see.
Abstract.
Yeah,
that's
you can be
schematic.
The
pure mass.
I mean, reduction is another thing that is kind of an interesting term. I mean, it kind of maps a little bit onto the abstraction and the mass language about dimension reduction and things, but I think essentially, as I've described at some level, what we're interested in is a kind of reductionism for this part of the space. But reductionism is curiously a very dirty word in some corners, which I find interesting. So that's probably not quite allowed either, but maybe we're doing dynamical process biology.
I mean, one word that is quite often attached to systems biology is integrative.
Yes,
although I think that's been so used, you wouldn't want to use it again. Nevertheless, it does get the idea of bringing things together.
Yeah, I've always liked integrative, but I've also found that confuses people. So, for example, the omics people thinks that means doing transcriptomics and proteomics.
That was a devastating remark.
Integrative and multi-scale is the other thing that comes up quite a lot.
Multi-scale.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And you know, that's very much in this space. Have we kind of exhausted the?
I think we need a beer.
Alex. It would be nice, as I say, I've been talking to people about this for a while, and I find a lot of people who've been thinking about it for a while. So it does seem that there's a sort of, you know, we're in a state, an excitable state, where something might coalesce on some stable output. But
really needs to convince major editor.
So I'm keen to try to catalyze that in some way, and I would be very happy to keep stirring things up or working with James, who now has power.
Really?
Yes. Has access to a very important journal in developmental biology.
I think it would be good to write something. To try and open up the debate.
I think so. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be a good idea, and I would be happy to help with that, but I would seriously need help, precisely because when it gets to writing the wiring diagrams and the equations that go with them, I can't do it.
Well, you could start a Google group. or something like that, some follow-up mechanism that allows, that makes it easy to contribute to a discussion.
There is an installment in that discussion.
I think this was a good start.